It's the Wonky Show. Today we're digesting the next steps for the free speech legislation for universities in England. We've published a new report on collaboration and sustainability, and we're discussing regional inequalities in admissions. It's all coming up.
We saw a misplaced fascination with headlines for themselves rather than for a serious attempt to safeguard freedom of speech and academic freedom. And it's precisely because this government cares about academic freedom that we are determined to get this right.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and joining me to ring the bell for a week in HE policy, we have three fantastic guests as always. In Litchfield, it's Richard Sykes, partner at Mills & Reeve. Richard, your highlight of the week, please.
A highlight of the week was a trip to Naples, which was a 21st birthday present to my son. And we enjoyed ourselves in that lovely, sophisticated city and went to see Napoli play Hellas Verona. Great stadium. Diego Maradona.
In Nottingham, it's Paul Greatrix, HE expert, and until recently, registrar at the University of Nottingham. Paul, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week, Mark, has been sitting around reading and thinking about life and the future, which I haven't been able to do for a very long time. So it's been a real joy to do that.
And in North London is Deborah McVitie, editor of Wonky. Deborah, your highlight of the week.
I'm going to go for a highlight from, it's a little bit out of date because it's really last week, but I had the pleasure of visiting some good friends at the University of Chester, and I got a lovely tour of the campus and a really great discussion about all the things that the university is thinking about doing in the future. And it was very heartwarming to know that even in times when there's not a lot of money sloshing around, universities are still kind of cracking on and trying to do their best.
Now, we start the week, as we have many times before, with free speech. Debbie, walk us through what's going on.
Yep. So one of the government's earliest actions in the HE policy world when it came into power last July was to suspend the implementation of the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act. And it was very clear at the time that this was not about saying we're going to repeal the act entirely. It was saying we're going to look at it. We're going to listen to the concerns that some people have expressed around whether this is going to create kind of greater tensions on campus, whether implications for some of what universities are doing overseas and all the rest of it. And we're going to see how we want to proceed. So yesterday, Bridget Phillips and the Secretary of State made an announcement in Parliament about what the plan will be going forward. So universities will still be required to promote free speech. The Office for Students will retain a director for free speech and academic freedom, and it will hear complaints from academics and external speakers about any perceived breach of free speech or academic freedom. So universities will still, you know, there will still be a condition of registration around this that universities will have to comply with. However, what will be removed is a statutory tort. Now that means that people who think that their free speech has been compromised will have to pursue their complaint through the OFS. They won't get an automatic right to sue universities in the courts. And also, quite importantly, students' unions will no longer be subject to direct regulation from the Office for Students. So student complaints around free speech will go to the Office of the Independent Adjudicator, which is where all the other student complaints go, which is arguably really where they should have been sent all along. And of course, it's worth saying that the timing of this announcement, mere days before the courts heard a legal challenge to government from the Free Speech Union, is of course entirely coincidental.
Thank you, Madam Deputy Speaker. What we inherited from the last government was not a genuine attempt to solve a genuine problem. It was a mess designed to put party ahead of country. We saw a misplaced fascination with headlines for themselves rather than for a serious attempt to safeguard freedom of speech and academic freedom. And it's precisely because this government cares about academic freedom and freedom of speech that we are determined to get this right, unlike the party opposite. We are not content to leave it to vice chancellors who have done too little for too long. Universities must be places of robust discussion where students' views are challenged, where academic freedom is central.
Right. So lots here. Paul, you've been banging a drum about the kind of regulatory burden aspects of this for the last couple of years. Do you think it's the legislation's been modified to a point that the sector can live with?
I think it has, yeah. I mean, whilst, you know, in broad terms, I would still argue that it is actually unnecessary legislation. It is nevertheless legislation that does exist. And to bin it all together, I think, would probably have caused more challenges for government than they actually want, especially as Debbie said, you know, with the court hearing from the Free Speech Union on the way. So I think it's been modified in a way that means that the sector can actually live with it. And of course, I mean, what universities and colleges have been doing is adapting their existing approach to free speech, which has a long legislative pedigree anyway, to come to terms with the anticipated new realities. And therefore, people are, in fact, already geared up to implement all of this, I think, in terms of a complaints procedure, a code of practice, and dealing with the promotion of free speech, not just the protection of it. So I think it can be managed without too much difficulty. It does, though, nevertheless, entail an increase in the regulatory burden. It means that the Office for Students will have to continue to grow its regulatory infrastructure to deal with this. And I think that at a time when we're facing lots of other financial challenges, it really isn't that welcome. But I can understand why the government have gone down this road.
Richard, I'm fascinated to get your take on this, because, I mean, on one hand, this means less work for the lawyers, doesn't it? Because the removal of the statutory tort. But I'm fascinated to know whether you think this is a good thing or a bad thing in terms of how it's ended up.
Well, I'm with Paul on the with the underlying idea that there was an act in 1986 that did much the same as this had done in terms of protecting free speech. What it didn't do was, of course, have a complaints process, which is what this act brought into place. I think it'll be interesting to see how the regulatory advice from the OFS will change, because I think we need to see that kind of detail in order to understand exactly what's going on, because the language of the legislation is unlikely to change in respect of those parts which are coming into force, while the complaints scheme itself, the Secretary of State is proposing to amend the provisions around that, which will require parliamentary time because it's in primary legislation. And so I think the devil is going to be in the detail on this. I don't mourn the loss of the tort, the statutory tort, because I think that was going to be probably used most frequently inappropriately and would just simply cost universities money. Maybe bad news for some lawyers, but actually, that invariably cases of that sort actually generate more heat than light.
The other thing that's still TBC, isn't it, is this stuff about the international overseas influence, Debbie. I mean, we've got a paper due to be published with all the detail about how the government's going to set out this policy. But is there anything we can read from, you know, perhaps the government's position on China to date, or its general, you know, it's only been a few months in, but do we have a sense of what the distance of travel has been between the last government and its stance here, which was driving, I think, some of this, particularly around its concerns about China, to kind of where we are now and what this newish Labour government is trying to do internationally?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things about this dimension of the Act was that it was sort of tagged on as a bit of an afterthought in the first place. So I think it sort of materialised as an amendment during the passage of the Free Speech Act, which was intended to focus on broadly, you know, the practices of universities and student unions and, you know, no platforming and protest and all the rest of it. So in that sense, I think what is a very complicated and challenging area never really belonged in that Act in the first place. And it's probably the right thing to say, let's take another look at this and see actually what we want to do in that space. But I suppose, you know, you're right to point out that there has been a kind of shift. Certainly, Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, was in China last week. Clearly, I think if the government is going to pursue, aggressive growth measures, particularly in the context of some of the other things we've been seeing around the gilt markets and kind of ongoing sort of economic challenge, it probably doesn't really want to create a situation where there's a kind of diplomatic challenge with China. But I think there's also a case to sort of say that, you know, wedging kind of provisions of that nature into an act like this is a pretty blunt instrument. And it's quite good for universities to have to be able to be a bit more sophisticated in some of this stuff.
I think that's absolutely right, Debbie. And I think the separation of these two things is really helpful, because they are really, really quite different. And the issues, the detail and complexity around the kind of foreign influence stuff is really complicated, right? So I think separating them out is really helpful. But on the free speech side, I mean, I think although the tort is gone, nevertheless, we will find that more and more people, you know, particularly from, I guess, the free speech union gang, will nevertheless pursue things through the OFS and then look to pursue them subsequently through the courts if dissatisfied. So this remains a kind of big deal for people who think about that free speech is challenged within universities. They are, of course, all the kind of people who already have many platforms and many vehicles to express their views. So the idea that they're somehow having their views stifled because they can't speak in a university about their pet topic is just fantasy. And the kind of day-to-day business of the the hundreds and hundreds of speakers that universities have every year and the need to maintain, you know, kind of good campus environments for all goes on in institutions. But it'll be the Free Speech Union that get the headlines in future still.
But what I'm trying to get my head around is what's the downside risk? So as you've pointed out, Paul, there's nothing new here. Universities and student unions have been dealing with these free speech issues for as long as anyone can remember. And on the site this week, we've got a explainer for the what's just happened in terms of all the changes. Jim and DK go into all that detail. I guess one of the points they make is that what's good about where Bridget Phillipson has landed is it's the onus is now on student unions and universities to continue that work together, you know, approach this issue with nuance, have these conversations in a grown-up sense, etc. And all that is fine. But what is, you know, we obviously the devil's in the detail, but what is the downside risk of this, of that, all that he's annoyed? Surely the Free Speech Union are going to be upset that they've lost the tort. So they can put thousands and thousands of complaints into Arif Ahmed. How on earth is he going to have the resources to deal with that? And even if these complaints come to some kind of decision, what's the worst that can happen? We're talking about fining universities. Has the OFS ever fined a university since the OFS was created? And if they did, you know, how much money was it? And I don't, you know, I'm not aware of that ever happening. I mean, I just think that this is quite a convoluted and unlikely process to get from, you know, Free Speech Union activists putting in something vexatious to OFS coming in and fining a university. It seems like the journey from A to B is almost impossible. Go on, Richard.
I can say that the OFS has imposed a monetary penalty, in the jargon, on at least one university and possibly more than one. The route through which a person bringing a complaint would probably go is that they would complain through the OFS complaint scheme. A decision would be made on the complaint as to whether or not it was justified or not. And then the OFS would probably separately consider that outcome as justified, whether or not it amounted to a breach of a condition of registration. And if they decided it was a breach of condition of registration, they would then be able to impose a monetary penalty or some other sanction on the higher education provider concerned. That is a bit of speculation and guesswork, I'll grant you, but it's a long route, but that is a route through which a penalty is imposed on the institution. It is not compensation to the complainant, although I think I recall that the original scheme did include an ability to impose some sort of compensation to the complainant, and indeed costs against the institution if the complaint was found partly to be justified or wholly justified.
I'll eat my hat if it happens once in the next 5 years, because I'll go on to.
Well, I mean, actually, but one of the things, of course, Richard, is that if, you know, as has already happened in other kind of contexts, it is perfectly possible then for an institution to say, well, we are going to challenge the decision of the OFS on this and take that to the courts, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And indeed,
so the thing could run on for years.
There'll be no meaningful difference between a complaint considered by the OFS and a complaint considered by the OIA. They'll both be subject to judicial review if there is something, you know, wrong with them. I did want to just go back also, if I may, to the two points that were just being mentioned before. First of all, one of the things was around the origin of the need for this, which was a focus on the actions of the student union and their no platforming. Of course, the Secretary of State's now seeking repeal of the duties on students' unions on the basis they were probably too complex for them to be required to comply with these sets of duties, albeit that they should protect freedom of speech. It'll be interesting to see how that operates in practice, because I'm not altogether certain it's widely understood that student unions are invariably wholly separate to the institution to which they attach themselves. And the other point was around the funding, the implementation of overseas funding monitoring measures. There's already some law in place that does similar things to that, the Foreign Influence Registration Scheme, which doesn't have a university or academic exemption, and in relation to which the relevant government department is working with HE institutions to develop the code of practice and the guidance in connection with that. So in some ways, that part of the Freedom of Speech Act, Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act, wasn't really needed.
I mean, I think it's, you know, it's good news that SUs have been taken out of it, but as you mentioned earlier, student unions and universities will continue to have to collaborate together. It just means that they can't be divided up legally, which I think is just really helpful.
I think the thing that's important here as well is that that, I mean, the university is sort of de facto the regulator of the SU. I mean, obviously, and the Charity Commission as well has a role to play. So there's, you know, I think adding another layer of regulation to what are very small and not enormously well-financed organisations, I think doesn't achieve the objective, which is, you know, it should always be the kind of test of whether law is helpful. The question I think is whether that work ongoing between universities and student unions changes in light of this new legislation. And actually, I do think that there's a case for OFS to have some kind of relationship with SUs, not only necessarily in this area, but across the piece. And because that's part of the way that OFS sort of understands the student interest and keeps abreast of what's going on with students. So I think there's something kind of softer to be done there around OFS and that SU landscape. But I certainly don't think kind of regulating free speech is the way into that.
There's probably a sort of sector-led job to be done, isn't there, in terms of, we made it, our colleagues on WikiSU has made a valiant effort with this a few years ago with a free speech code for SUs to sign up to. There's some really interesting stuff in there about how universities and SUs should work together. You know, there could be a sector-led effort to respond to this, because I think that it would be, a lot of this is well within the gifts of SUs and universities to, head off in terms of we know exactly the sorts of complaints that are going to come and exactly the sorts of people that are going to be trying to use and manipulate the system for the reasons we've talked about. So there's got to be a kind of grown-up way of approaching this, and that it's consistent across the sector, hasn't there? Because it's just the people who want to utilize this want to create the flashpoints, and they're doing it for media attention, the pages of the Times, etc. And a lot of that feels like we can see it off at the before it gets there, right?
But I'm not certain we can see it off. I mean, getting the procedures right, having the right code of practice, the right internal complaints arrangements, the good relationship between the union and the university, all of those things are really important. Having the right attitude towards promoting and protecting free speech and academic freedom within the university or college is also really, really important. But you can do all of those things, and Universities UK and the NUS, I'm sure, will work together to provide, kind of better material for everyone in that regard. But it will not stop the kind of person who was the kind of person who wanted the tour pursuing things till the end of time, try and, get their day in court or their column inches in the Telegraph. So I just don't think, we just got to live with that and try and minimize the likelihood of it happening, but accept that that's part of the landscape now and try not to worry about it too much, because it doesn't actually matter.
All right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Claire Swales, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about the Access to Higher Education Diploma. I'm part of the team at the QAA, which since 1997 has been managing the scheme for the recognition and quality assurance of this award. Last year, we registered our millionth student onto one of these Access to HE courses designed to offer specialist routes into higher education for adult returners to learning who don't hold traditional university entry qualifications. We and our partners have also recently completed some research into the barriers to study experienced by these students. And in our blog, we consider some of the practical measures that providers have introduced to help students overcome those barriers, and how the lessons we've learned might more broadly support initiatives to promote widening participation in HE.
We've done a whole new report on financial sustainability with our friends at Mills and Reeve. Paul, walk us through that, please.
Well, there's been a huge amount of discussion in the sector over the past recent months and indeed years about the sustainability of higher education institutions at a time of significant financial challenge, and lots of chat about how we ensure kind of long-term success for our individual institutions, but also how we prevent institutions going bust, what to do in relation to universities or colleges that are under significant financial strain or distress, and then what can be done to support greater collaboration between institutions in administrative domains, and the possibility of supporting mergers. So what this report really helpfully does, I think, is highlight some of the issues around policy and the legal frameworks, essentially identifying that there's a huge number of gaps here, and recognizing that given that what the challenges are over the coming years, we actually need more support and more framework in order to enable us and enable institutions, enable the sector to actually get through the challenge challenges that we're facing. So there's a series of really interesting recommendations in here about establishing a kind of special administrative regime to support, ensure that, you know, where there is a market exit, that happens in an orderly fashion, but also some guidance on how competition law should be applied, because that's a really big issue where you're looking at potential mergers or collaboration, and also all the other kind of legal and administrative and procurement and VAT stuff that gets in the way of all these things. But the big picture is we are in a turbulent time. There are lots of problems facing institutions, a general recognition that there needs to be some kind of structural support, but it doesn't exist at the moment. So it's a series of recommendations how that can happen. And there's some comments and input from a variety of heads of institution in there, which I think is particularly interesting in colouring in some of the challenges that exist, where you've got a sector which is essentially being pushed down a road of competition rather than collaboration and being asked now to come back into working together to establish a sustainable future. So I think it's a really interesting and timely piece.
Hmm. So, I mean, Richard and Debbie, co-authors of the report, so I think lots has had us. But I guess where to start, I think this question about collaboration is fascinating, isn't it? Because often a lot of people see that as a sort of code for mergers, but it's not necessarily what you were driving at in this report. And obviously lots of downsides to that approach, aren't there?
No, well, I think the kind of starting point, the question was, okay, what the question we went in with and what actually emerged actually ended up being rather different. So I'll sort of try and disentangle that. I think the sort of starting point was, if you've got an institution that is really struggling, what can reasonably be asked of institutions around it, either geographically or kind of, you know, sort of, you know, contiguous in other ways? What are the incentives? What are the enablers for institutions to be supportive in that situation? So that might mean, in some cases, taking on kind of displaced students. It might mean, you know, working with that institution to set up some kind of collaborative arrangements or whatever. Or indeed, it might mean kind of acquisition and merging with that institution. And we wanted to try and understand what would be the kind of upsides, what would be the downsides, what would be the barriers, you know, what support might be needed to enable one institution to support another. But coming out of that, and, you know, and it was very, very clear that there's a real kind of, you know, the expectation is, you know, that if you're an institution that's struggling, you're sort of on your own at the minute. You know, there's not a kind of expectation. But I think one of the things that we probably do see is that behind the scenes, policymakers are sort of reaching out to other institutions and saying, what can you do here? Can you take on this institution? And, you know, and there's a whole kind of basket of things around financial distress and the management of financial distress and the enablement of institutions to kind of connect around that, up to and including full merger, if that's appropriate. Although there's lots of challenges with merger when you're talking, you know, in a context of financial distress. But in the conversations that we had with heads of institution and with sector representatives and with boards of governors and including actually, you know, with a lender to the sector as well, kind of trying to understand that perspective, there was this really underpinning sense that saying financial sustainability is the thing that we're dealing with right now, but what would it look like if we were just more enabled to collaborate strategically, you know, for the long term? What are all the opportunities that arise from that? And actually, how much more of a positive agenda could it be if it wasn't kind of framed in the sense of being like, oh, we're all struggling, we're all on our knees and we need to be efficient and we need to share services or whatever it is, and was much more about thinking, how could we realize more benefits? How could we realize more impact for our regions, for students and so on, if we were able to do more of this collaborative kind of activity? And I think the kind of key thing here is about what's the role of government in creating a framework in which universities are protected from, you know, so at the minute, there's, I think it was a really, really salient point made by one of the chairs of governors that we spoke to that said, there seems to be this expectation that we're supposed to be talking to each other about collaboration opportunities, but at the minute we're prevented by competition law from doing that. So, you know, what government needs to kind of, and the regulator needs to sort of step up and say, it is okay to have these conversations. Here's how we will facilitate that. And we will actively solicit advice from, for example, the Competition and Market Authority about what the limits of that are, that, you know, what's in the interest of the student as consumer and what is not in the interest of the student as consumer for these conversations to happen. There just needs to be more being able to kind of start some of these discussions now before the government launches its HE reform agenda could actually just open up a larger sense of what those possibilities might be that could then feed into that agenda and enable the government to sort of say, well, this is what we think that the future looks like. There's a lot of sense of kind of saying, well, until the government tells us what it thinks the future is for higher education, then it's going to be very hard to, you know, do anything at all. But I think there's a case, you know, and we're basically in this report, we're saying, well, actually, we could act now on some of these legal and regulatory challenges so that future can be more kind kind of readily mapped out, you know, earlier than just waiting for government to kind of announce it.
Just on, I mean, I think that part of the challenge for me is that this, you know, what the report really helpfully sets out is very much a kind of longer term view of the way these things should be approached on a sector basis. But no one is really taking that long term view at the moment because the challenges are so immediate. But the other thing is that there is just a complete absence of that kind of sector perspective on how things should be organized. So whilst Debbie's right, I mean, waiting around for a government to come up with a framework is probably not a great idea. There aren't other vehicles for that kind of level of coordination currently existing. So the Office for Students at the moment, whilst it's, you know, looking to try and be supportive, I think, to institutions in trouble, doesn't yet have the base or the skills or the infrastructure to enable it to support that kind of genuine, you know, interventionist brokerage that is required in order to facilitate long-term collaboration or indeed merger. And all of this requires money, time, investment, commitment when everything else is under huge pressure as well. So I think it's really, really challenging. But government at the end of the day needs to decide what it wants to do here, right? Does it want to allow things to collapse and then try and find a way to pick up pieces? Or does it want to put in a regime which will support some kind of managed approach to dealing with these really, really difficult and intractable issues?
Mm. And Richard, to what extent do you feel like there's the regulatory framework right now can enable any of that? So I mean, obviously OFS is recommitted to dealing with financial sustainability, but should there be more from a regulator's point of view as well as the government?
The short answer to that is yes, but carefully, I suppose, which is that as Debbie identified, the things that perhaps there are some easy wins, for example, where services could be shared and similar facilities used and those sorts of things, which wouldn't necessarily cause all sorts of competition issues, but there is a VAT problem in there and various other bumps in the road that may cause difficulty in sharing services, loss of identity, those kind of things. But then there are some much bigger points over oversupply of some courses in some areas and undersupply of those programs and courses in other areas that would need the obvious way to address is by institutions talking to each other and sharing out who does what. Well, that is just anti-competitive, and as things currently can't stand, couldn't really happen, but is an obvious way to sort of address those concerns. There's also this, and this is a theme I keep coming back to in my mind, there's also this at times misunderstanding, I think, in lots of the debate, not here, but in lots of the debate elsewhere, that all students are the same and all universities or higher education providers are the same. And we're talking about, if I can put it this way, one product. And that, of course, is simply not true. And so we wind up with this situation of, well, what would bring, hypothetically speaking, a large successful higher tariff, higher education provider to take on the students or the entire institution of a struggling, perhaps lower tariff, higher education provider? Because that would be the most likely way in which provision in certain areas were able to be continued. And I don't know that we have any sort of answer to that. And indeed, I don't think during the course of the discussions, Debbie, we got an answer to that sort of thing. What would persuade large, successful institution to take on struggling institution?
I think one of the things that came out was that, you know, and I think that was really important, was that every head of institution, you know, pretty much that we spoke to said, of course we would give it due consideration because our concern is, you know, that thing where institutions have been sort of set up in a way that the expectation is that they look to their own interests sort of first and solely, I think is an overstatement of the case. Any head of institution is looking to their region and the, you know, and the environment and the kind of broader kind of success of the sector as well. So they would absolutely consider it. However, the most enormous risks involved is particularly in taking on an institution that's not financially sustainable. And one of those is about the pure finances, because obviously if that institution is kind of hemorrhaging money, then that then becomes your problem. One of those is about just that kind of broad metrics, the regulatory environment, and that kind of sense that, you know, there would need to be kind of a protected space to say, we need to be given the opportunity to regularize, to create this new entity that would be formed out of the merger of two institutions or the kind of acquisition of a bit of another institution, and get back on a firm path. And we need the regulator to understand that, and then there needs to be a degree of trust then with the regulator to be able to create that space. And I think in a lot of cases there's that sense that if they're saying, well, if we might do it if we were bunged enough cash to kind of cover our costs, but also do not underestimate the sheer administrative burden of that process. And you know, where there have been mergers recently in the sector, it's been very clear that there's not really a playbook. The legal kind of implications of the transfer of all the kind of liabilities and claims and accreditations and all the rest of it from one institution to another, there isn't really a kind of legal process for that. And you know, nobody's saying that there's too many universities in this country and everybody should merge and this is the answer to everyone's problems. I think, you know, there may be a school of thought in there, but it's certainly not kind of in this report. It's saying that where a university is able to either kind of reach out and support another university in that way, or whether there is actually a strategic case for merger, then it would be helpful to kind of remove barriers to that process so that it then became possible.
I do agree with that. I do think that the scale of activity and investment and time and energy are generally underestimated. I mean, the mergers that have happened in the sector, whether from a view of positive enhancement or out of distress or acquisition for strategic reasons, have happened over years, and they've taken huge amounts of time and effort on all parts to get them over the line, and huge efforts and cost. And these kind of things just can't happen overnight, and they do require investment. But they also mean that any institution involved in that will have its eye taken off all its other priorities as well. So it's a really significant strategic shift for anyone as well, particularly when they're facing other challenges. The other thing just to mention, I think, is that yes, I agree that taking away the obstacles in terms particularly of, kind of collaboration, shared services is helpful. But the legacy of attempts to deal with sharing of services in the FE sector and in other public services is not a happy one, right? The promises of a huge efficiencies and savings just rarely, if ever, materialize, and they require huge amounts of investment, and they require really the platform to be burning quite badly before people will even contemplate it. So that isn't a nirvana.
Yeah, I think this is real tension between, what are we doing this for? And I think, that kind of sense, particularly when if all your focus is on kind of cost management, shall we say, if not necessarily cost savings, then so we're saying let's embark on this kind of, grandiose scheme to, create a new, whatever it is for the, X in our region, and we're going to work with all the universities and all the rest of it, just feels like a very much a kind of, this is not a priority for our institution right now. And then of course, when things feel stable and there's money around, then actually that it still doesn't really feel like a priority because there's no burning platform to kind of drive it. I think it's that kind of, and that's where I think you probably do need, one of the other things as well, of course, is that came out of some of our conversations was there's a bit of skepticism, I think, from boards that, the universities have the sort of skills to do this stuff. Because, if you've never had to do it and it's not been a priority of your institution, then why would executive teams have that skill set? And therefore the hurdles are even greater. So it does feel like I think the kind of point here as well is, so given that all of those things are true, if it is something that there actually is real benefit to be realized from, which I think there probably is, but it's got to be kind of done quite carefully, as Richard says, then government and or the regulator and or kind of external actors actually have to really facilitate that and create the space for those benefits to be kind of thought through and developed and become kind of more meaningful strategic drivers than that sort of immediate sense of, well, either we're cost saving or we don't need to do this.
We'll put a link to Connect More, the report we're talking about, in the show notes.
Hello, it's Jim from the team here with news of our exciting student experience event in March. UKHE has a great reputation, but as the resource envelope tightens, it's not clear that what's been sold to students as a higher education experience can compensate for high costs, overcrowded facilities, and stressed out academic and support staff. The result? Widespread health and wellbeing issues, stubborn awarding gaps, and the erosion of opportunity as demand for higher education begins to slip. Some say the future lies in a great unbundling, but in truth, reports of the death of the full-time 3-year degree have probably been greatly exaggerated. So with a new government, a renewed commitment to access and student success, and a regional regeneration agenda, there's an opportunity to build a different vision for a full-time student experience that acknowledges that students are citizens too. They're passengers, clients, patients, employees, voters, parents, volunteers, and taxpayers, each with their own distinct needs and future potential. So as our unique student experience event returns for its seventh year, we'll try to climb out of the doldrums over the student experience debate, asking the question, what would it take for the UK to offer the world's best student experience? We'll get beyond trying to discern the student interest and work towards an ambitious, positive vision for students' participation in higher education. We'll also spend some time interrogating some of the wicked problems associated with particular groups of students in HE. Disabled students, PGR students, students who live locally or less locally to their campus, and the students whose work-based learning means that even the word student, let alone the policy surrounding them, can seem alien. On the day, we'll round up key findings into the student experience from the past year and launch exciting new findings on the student experience beyond the classroom. It's the essential event for anyone working on policy and delivery for students. That's the secret life of students at the Shaw Theatre in London on the 18th of March. We can't wait to see you there. Tickets and more details on wonky.com.
Now, Neil's been looking at regional inequality in university admissions. Richard, talk us through that, please.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. Well, I didn't know what NEON was, so I needed to, dad joke alert, shine some light on it. It's the National Education Opportunities Network, a charity existing to support those who are involved in widening access to higher education. And what they've done is undertaken some analysis of data from the DfE, HESA, and other sources into the progression of state school students who are in receipt of free school meals compared to state school students who are not in receipt of free school meals. And they've looked at those entering higher education in 2021-22 and those entering in 2022-23. And there's another small limitation on the data set that they've looked at because it's only those who are entering higher education by the age of 19, i.e. those who didn't take a year off. None of this, I think, diminishes the value of the work they've done, but it's important to know a little bit, I think, of that limitation on the data set they've looked at. Anyhow, the starting point of what NEON have found is that nationally, in the 2 years they've looked at, about 49% of state school students who don't receive free school meals entered higher education, while that figure was about 29% for those who do receive free school meals. And that's a gap of roughly 20 percentage points higher than the gap of roughly 17 percentage points 10 years earlier. And they're saying that stagnation in terms of progress and the rate of higher education participation in some state school meals. They're saying that that's a stagnation in terms of the progress in the rate of higher education participation for state school pupils receiving school meals. They've also looked at it by region and by county, and there are regional inequalities, they say, in higher education progression, with the difference between the highest and the lowest exceeding 50 percentage points, which did really strike me as being a very significant difference. They've got a number of suggested responses, increasing the resource committed to addressing this, possibly by having higher education providers pooling resource, and that's a link back perhaps to something we were talking about just a second or two ago. Setting regional targets maybe for progression and having national focuses on smaller groups that may fall into these categories, such as gypsies, Roma and travellers, care experience students, etc. It's a genuinely interesting piece of work, I think, and certainly shines rather a bright light on this group of pupils and this group of talent that may not be achieving its full potential in higher education.
Debbie, this seems sort of laser targeted at Bridget Phillipson's office, doesn't it? In terms of what they're trying to get at for the next few months, and that's probably no bad thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the more we are able to look at data that is segmented by region in this way, the more there can be a really interesting conversation. Because I think, you know, and that kind of it makes no sense at all to talk about progression of free school meals at the kind of national level, because of course every region that you look at, the kind of issues are going to be different. So we live in Enfield. It's got the lowest progression rates. This is a suburb of London. It's got one of the lowest progression rates in the country. But also there's the same kind of problem in Herefordshire, which is, you know, obviously it's an incredibly rural. So you've got to really understand understand the dynamic and the ecosystem and the provision and the supply and the demand and the kind of what's shaping those things, you know, in those different areas, and then come up with, you know, and how that then connects to things like transport links and education provision and the labour market, and, you know, and then come up with ways of thinking about those things that is region appropriate. Now, I think it's really important to say also that because universities already collaborate, or, you know, in their regions on this sort of stuff, they will hold an awful lot of insight, kind of qualitative insight about what's really going on. And I sort of find myself reading this report thinking, ooh, that, you know, that feels like the kind of follow-up is sort of saying, okay, let's deep dive into some of those areas, get the universities that are working in those areas to just pull their, you know, to sort of surface some of that kind of sort of informal knowledge about what's actually affecting those progression rates, and you know, look at where there's perhaps cold spots for outreach as well. I think it opens up a really useful way of thinking about this stuff. And I guess the key thing that NEON really wants to come back is more systematized regional funding for access, and sort of, you know, a greater enablement for universities to kind of carry on doing that work.
Yeah, and Paul, you obviously left your institutional context out, but when you were when you were at Nottingham, how would you approach this?
I think what this does expose is that the nature, the scale of the challenge in terms of ensuring, you know, equity of access just hasn't gone away, and as NEON pointed out, it's actually got worse. Despite significant investment over many years by institutions in activity, and I think that there is collaboration going on around the country. There are some really good examples, but it is not consistent. And I think that certainly, you know, in the kind of greater Nottingham area, the two main universities in Nottingham, Nottingham Trent University of Nottingham, did work very, very closely in a whole range of access issues, which was productive. But the scale of the challenge in the greater Nottinghamshire area is such that, you know, it was really, I think, only partly addressing it. And this, you know, this is deeply embedded within, you know, kind of structural educational systems within our country, which mean that, you know, from the very, very earliest stage, you know, attitudes are embedded. So it does require a kind of whole system approach, I think, starting with, you know, very, very low, you know, early years education and support. And certainly, you know, everyone's investing in it, right? But it's not delivering. And, you know, just telling universities and colleges to spend more clearly isn't the answer. But finding ways, as Debbie said, to harness that money more collectively for, you know, targeted benefit, I think is probably the right way to do it. Although every institution will hate that in some respects.
One of the things not raised in the report particularly at all is, you know, at what point in schooling the effort and drive is best focused. A long time ago, discussing with a then vice chancellor elsewhere in the country, you know, in one of the major cities of the country, it was completely obvious to her that it wasn't universities that needed to be spending money on the recruiting people of particular kinds of sixth former. Actually, the money needed to be invested in the preschool areas and in the infant school, because that was the point at which differences in attainment between the poorest and the most and the wealthiest pupils really started being expressed. And by year seven, we're pretty much insurmountable for gap in attainment. And so it's targeting resource in the right places, and frankly, frequently raising aspirations as well as availability. Noting that Herefordshire is one of the areas that comes off least well, as it were, in the report.
But what that exposes is the need again for a really long term view and a kind of consistent approach. I mean, one of the things my former institution had done very successfully is work with a national charity, Inter-University, who provide very targeted support for most disadvantaged students in a kind of after school environment for them and their families, an environment where they can go and study, do their homework, but also be supported as well before and after school. And those Inter-University centres in some of the most disadvantaged areas of Nottingham have been going for over a decade now, and, you know, thousands of students have been through them, and many of them have progressed to higher education. But that requires a commitment of a decade or more in order to actually see those kids from the age of 8 progressing into higher education. And that kind of long-term, sustained, consistent approach is something that we, generally lack in our education system anyway. And I think underpins part of the problem that Neon have identified.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on Wookiee.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wookiee Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Richard, Debbie, Paul and Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay Wookiee.